Okay, so today we've got a long talk. It's one of those talks you can doze off in the middle of it and wake up and think, oh, he's still talking about the same thing, and go back to sleep again. So this is called The Perfection of Energy. Energy. So yesterday I spoke of, I think probably I have to make my talks very controversial and pointy so that you don't fall asleep. So if I'm saying things that are outrageous, it's just to make sure you don't fall asleep. It's not necessarily my position, my view. So yesterday I spoke of the arising of the bodhicitta. And one of the things actually I didn't explore, I don't think, was the meaning of the term. Chitta is translated as mind or heart or consciousness. It's not mind in the sense of mind in the sense merely of thoughts. It's mind, heart, consciousness. And Bodhi can be translated as enlightenment or as awakening. And there's many different translations of the term around. There's thought of enlightenment. That's a very common one, which is terribly weak, and really doesn't do justice to the term at all. But you do find this even in some modern translations, the thought of enlightenment. Well, it's much, much more than just thinking about enlightenment. That's very, very poor and weak. Awakening mind is the way Crosby and Skilton translate it in their translation of the Bodhicharya Avatara, which is quite good. Bodhi mind is what you find in quite a few Tibetan translations. Thurman in the Vimalakirti Nidesha translates it as the spirit of enlightenment, which is quite good. Gunther translates it as the enlightened attitude, which in some ways is quite good, because it's I think what he's trying to get at is that it's something you bring to every everything that you encounter. You bring, or you try to bring, the enlightened attitude to it. But again, it isn't quite the thing. Bhante translates it as the will to enlightenment. He brings out the volitional aspect, the will to enlightenment for all beings. Brings out the dynamic aspect of it. It's not, of course, an individual will, and we're not talking about willfulness. What we're really talking about is the powerful urge, the powerful movement towards enlightenment for all beings. Traditionally, in the Mahayana Sutras and commentaries on the arising of this will to enlightenment for all beings, the Bodhisattva makes a great vow, a great resolution, pranidhana as it's called, or great vows, great resolutions, which express precisely how he will express that will to enlightenment in his life, what he will actually do to deepen his wisdom and to express his compassion. The Bodhisattva also, of course, embarks upon the practice of the six paramitas, the six perfections, for the benefit of all beings. In all these descriptions of the Bodhisattva path, you get the impression of tremendous energy, endeavour and resolution, of tremendous striving and spiritual effort, and of tremendous creativity. And it's clear that if we're to pursue the Bodhisattva path, we need energy. Indeed, I haven't been able to follow this up, but this is disputed, but one scholar believes that the term bodhisattva is actually a wrong Sanskritization of the Pali bodhisatta, which means a being energizing for enlightenment. So the bodhi being, which is what we usually understand a bodhisattva to be, this particular scholar believes really the original term was somebody energizing for Bodhi, which, whether or not that's true, doesn't matter. It expresses what a bodhisattva is, a being energizing for enlightenment. So to follow the bodhisattva path, the Buddhist path, we need energy. We need to be energetic. We need, in other words, virya, which is, of course, one of the paramitas. In the usual order of the paramitas, it's the fourth paramita after kshanti and before dhyana. But I want to begin our exploration of the paramitas with virya. Throughout Mahayana literature, virya is praised. Without it, there's no progress. Without it, positive qualities don't grow. As it says in one text, enlightenment is easy for the hard working. And it's said sometimes, well, all the paramitas require effort. If there's no effort, there's no dana, there's no shila, there's no kshanti, there's no meditation, and so on. So that's why we're starting with virya, with effort, with energy. The Sanskrit virya literally means the state of being a strong man. The state of being a strong man. That is actually the literal translation. The word virya is the root of our own vigour, and even it's the root of our own term virtue. Originally virtue meant strength, which is very interesting. Virya is variously translated as diligence, strenuousness, effort, vigour, enthusiasm, even energy. But of course it's not any old energy. I mean, there's plenty of energy around, but it's not necessarily virya. Shantideva defines virya as energy in pursuit of the good and the wholesome. Energy in pursuit of the good and the wholesome. So in the Buddhist context, virya is the energy directed towards the cultivation of skillful mental states. The cultivation, the maintenance of, the expression of skillful mental states. And you'll be familiar with this, of course, with the four right efforts. When this energy is free-flowing, as it were, it's the natural flow of skillful, creative, loving energy. And it's blissful. It's blissful, this free-flowing energy. Atisha speaks of the very perfection of vigour, vigour that is the expression of wisdom, in these terms. As you take great pleasure in the realisation of voidness, your life becomes one ever-flowing, transcendent effort. It's really lovely. As you take great pleasure in your realisation of shunyata, your life becomes one ever-flowing, transcendent effort. This virya, of course, doesn't mean running around being busy in an anxious, busybody sort of way. There is a lot of energy in the world. There's plenty of energy in the world. Energy makes the world go around. Energy is the world going around, but it's not necessarily virya. Gross laziness, says Gampopa, is being addicted to such activities as hoarding wealth and subduing enemies. So making money for yourself and competing with others is gross laziness. There might be lots of energy going on, but it's not virya, it's laziness, gross laziness. You put it another way, you could say that any activity, no matter how energetic, that's not directed towards deepening your personal spiritual practice and benefiting others, that's gross laziness. So, we could be strongly practicing virya, just sitting in our chair, apparently doing nothing. But internally, we're occupied with cultivating skillful states for the benefit of all. But don't misunderstand that either. Some presentations of Buddhism and meditation can give the impression that any directed effort is somehow wrong or dangerous. If you try to direct your effort, ooh, dangerous. That's, you know, you're going to get willful. And the emphasis is on the real spiritual practice is all about letting go, relaxing, doing nothing. That's it. Well, letting go and relaxing are important, of course, we know that. But only in the context, the overall context of making spiritual effort. No actual Buddhist tradition, as far as I know, in practice repudiate the need for spiritual effort. Some might say, well, Shinran's Jodo Shinshu, the true Pure Land school, surely don't emphasise personal spiritual effort. But I can assure you, if you actually read the life of Honen, who was Shinran's teacher, if you read the life of Shinran, or if you read the life of Ippen, one of the descendants of Shinran, one of his disciples, you get the impression of lives of tremendous spiritual energy, and indeed heroic energy, because they had to put up with persecution. And they certainly worked for the benefit of others, especially for the poor and the needy. Honen and Shinran went among the very, very poor and neglected in society to teach them the Dharma. They would, of course, all say it wasn't their own personal energy, it's all the grace of Amitabha. But certainly they weren't just sitting around doing nothing. Whatever it is, it's beneficial, energetic activity. I personally don't believe that any spiritual progress or human progress can be made without effort. And I'm very suspicious of approaches that advocate non-doing. And I'm in good company in saying that. The great Harquin, the great Zen master Harquin, was extremely critical of what he called dead sitting. Dead sitting, which was a particular kind of just sitting practice around in Japan at his time. He believed that it just led to inertia and a kind of preciousness where people became so sensitive that they couldn't even do anything like the simple tasks of making a cup of tea. They became so sensitive. And he was very, very strident in his criticisms of this kind of practice. And he said, one of his great maxims indeed, is the lotus born in the fire is far superior to the lotus born in water. And he advocated very strongly the practice of meditation in the context of activity. Yes, you need to meditate, you need to strive in meditation, but you need to do it in the context of activity, of a life of action. The opposite of virya is, of course, laziness. It's interesting, Bhante has said in a famous aphorism where he talks about the besetting sins of different organised religions, that the besetting sin of organised, institutionalised Buddhism, which he saw something of in the East, is laziness and indifference. And this is something, I think, to watch out for. In Buddhism, thankfully, there's no God. There's no fear of punishment, therefore. And the spiritual community is a free association of individuals. But, we don't boss each other around. We try not to. And, we encourage one another and people make their own decisions and all the rest of it. But you can, in that sort of environment, end up making yourself very comfortable. You do a bit of work on yourself. You make yourself a bit happier. You get into a nice groove. But that's about it. But the perfection of virya makes it clear that there is always more to do. There's always more work to do upon oneself and for the benefit of others. That's very, very clear. Laziness is explored a bit in Buddhism. The ancient Buddhists, with their wonderful traditions of analysis, which continues to this day, lay it bare. Gampopa, as well as speaking of gross laziness, speaks of lassitude and idleness. By lassitude, he means a state of mental inertia. Your mind is inert, uninterested, so you become sleepy, dull and dreamy. I hope that's not happening while I'm speaking. Maybe I'm just boring. You become dreamy, a daydreamer, a fantasist, avoiding what is, avoiding your actual situation. You kind of vague out. By idleness, Gampopa means, and this is interesting, faint-heartedness. You lack confidence, thinking, how can I do it? How can I change? How can I follow this path? So you end up not doing anything. And of course, this lack of self-confidence, this faint-heartedness, and it's very sad that we suffer from this, that people suffer from this. But it can be a very convenient way of remaining idle and inert and avoiding what needs to be done. I notice it in myself, that how often I kind of cop out, I avoid engaging with something with the very convenient excuse of, well, I don't feel that confident. As though that somehow makes me kind of uniquely unqualified to engage in a particularly difficult practice of the Dharma. We do experience lack of confidence, but we can do something about that. There's no let off. But let's move on to Virya itself. Look at the positive. And I'm going to consider Virya Paramita, the perfection or the perfecting of Virya, by looking at the five kinds of Virya. This is a traditional Mahayana set. There's first of all the Virya which is ever ready. Secondly, the Virya which is applied work. Thirdly, the Virya which does not lose heart. Fourthly, the Virya which does not turn back. And finally, the Virya which is never satisfied. So, the Virya which is ever ready. I'll probably spend a bit more time on this one. Bhante, following the traditions, particularly as presented in Know Your Mind, Mind of Buddhist Psychology, describes this as the pure capacity for Virya. The Virya which is ever ready is the pure capacity for Virya. In other words, your Virya, your positive spiritual energy, is aroused. There is an enthusiasm for the spiritual life, for following the Bodhisattva path. This means, of course, that we need to be sparked off. We need to be ignited. I mentioned how thrilled I was listening to Bhante's lecture on the bodhicitta, the way he evoked the bodhicitta for me. He sparked me off. He roused my energy, my aspiration. Actually, I was sparked off even before then in my readings. In particular, my first experience of the Sevenfold Puja, which was the first time I came along to a class run by an order member. This was in Brighton many years ago. The first class I went to was a long metta-bhavana, followed by the Sevenfold Puja. I suppose it's just like what we're doing, you know, in the evenings here, a long metta-bhavana followed by the Sevenfold Puja. Well, I found the metta-bhavana extremely difficult, especially because I was trying to sit in a, you know, in the proper posture, which nearly, well, I think it probably has done my back in permanently by the feeling of it. But anyway, it's a detail. But the puja was incredible. Doing the puja, I was saying words that I knew. They seemed incredibly familiar. I'd never encountered a puja before. And when we were chanting the mantras, my spiritual energies, for want of a better term, were aroused, were woken up. And I had this joyous realization that I was going to devote my life to the Dharma. I didn't know what that meant, but that's precisely what I felt. And I can remember at the time of my ordination talking about the stimulation of spiritual energy. I definitely experienced that as my energy being sparked off, a deep, almost primal kind of spiritual energy or energy was activated by Bhante at the time of my ordination. And I still feel in touch with that energy. Not everybody experiences ordination like that, and it doesn't mean that my ordination was better than other people's, but that was my particular experience. And I find it interesting reflecting on this, that these experiences of energy being sparked off are associated with encountering a myth. In the case of hearing Bhante talk about the bodhicitta, I think actually what I came into contact with was the myth of the bodhicitta, the myth of the bodhisattva, the story, the great story of what life is for, of working to bring about the liberation of the world. You can express it in other ways, but it was a great myth that I felt introduced to. In the case of a puja, it was actually performing the liturgy of that myth, the liturgy of the myth of the bodhicitta. And of course, at the time of my ordination, it was being in contact with a person, with somebody who I felt was in touch with, was part of that myth, who introduced me, and the energy was very much associated with the visualization practice I was given, the mantra I was given, was associated with a particular archetype associated with Guru Rinpoche. So these things sparked me off. In these different ways, my energy was aroused. You could also say that an ardent desire arose an ardent desire and longing to lead the spiritual life. We usually regard desire as something unskillful. But of course that's not so. It's not all desire is unskillful. In the Abhidharma, we have this word, this mental event, chanda, which can be translated as desire or intense interest. And it's one of the, what they call, object-determining mental events. It's how we, it's one of the ways in which we engage with an object. It's very clear in the sense realm. You're travelling on a train or a bus or a plane, and you glimpse out of the corner of your eye that flash of glossy black hair, and there's that whiff of very sweet smelling perfume, and your interest is aroused, your chanda is aroused, and of course your desire is aroused, and there's all kinds of association with glimpses of black glossy locks and the whiff of perfume, and you know, your whole being starts to engage with all that, you know, if not actually turning your head irresistibly, at least doing it all in your mind, because you know, you suddenly might move on, oh they've gone, and you go through it all in your mind. Or in meditation we become interested. This is the way we can become concentrated. We become interested, fascinated even, in the object of meditation, in our breath. This is one of the things we need to really look for in doing the mindfulness of breathing. Just become, start to become interested, fascinated, drawn into the breath. It's actually a very wonderful, beautiful process. Or indeed the person to whom you're developing metta, becoming interested and fascinated in them, or just in the whole process of meditation, developing interest, even in the problems in meditation, becoming interested in them. Or, of course, if you're doing visualization practice, in the Buddhas, in the Bodhisattvas. This is why visualization is so powerful for some people, because it excites a very positive kind of desire. You really need, in a visualization practice, to be successful in it, to really see the sensuous beauty of the image that you're visualizing. The long eyes, the beautiful long almond eyes, the color of the eyes, the color of the skin, the beautiful adornments. One becomes interested, fascinated, and then absorbed in the meditation. The energy flows into the meditation. Of course, it's very important not to wait to be sparked off. That's too passive. You know, I remember Bhante talking at one time in the very early days of the movement, just how passive people were, sort of expecting, because he was a spiritual teacher, expecting to be sparked off by him, and just sort of sitting around waiting, as it were, to be sparked off. Well, you know, as if one has a, you know, because somebody's a spiritual teacher, you know, you have a right to be sparked off by them. Well, that's completely ridiculous. You have to be working to spark yourself off. You have to take responsibility for arousing your pure capacity for virya. If you're doing that yourself, there's a chance of being sparked off by other people. But if you're not doing it yourself, it's unlikely that you'll, you know, even if somebody's doing a lot to try and spark you off, it's very unlikely that you'll get sparked off, unless they're a very great teacher. It's very interesting. I remember once hearing a lecture about Sir Michael Tippett, the English composer, and he was having difficulty finding something to write. He would sometimes just, well, he got this tip, I think, from Ravel, the composer Ravel. He'd just sort of stand with his back to the piano and just kind of just go up and down with his, not knowing what keys he was hitting, just trying to find a sound that would spark him off, that would spark him into, you know, creating another piece of music. I thought that was brilliant. And it's sometimes like that, you know, with life, with our practice. We just, We've just got to try things. Sometimes in meditation you feel as though you're up against a wall, or you just feel very arid. We'll start throwing stuff at that. Just try something. Try some different thoughts. Just lob stuff at throw stuff at your experience to see what gets sparked off. So I've spoken of images, people, myths sparking you off, rousing your energy, but there's other things too. Ideas are very important too, as well, in terms of sparking us off. I think it's very important to really cultivate being intellectually stimulated, learning how to think, getting our thinking processes going. Very, very important in the arousal and the arousing of energy. I also think physical stimulation is very important. It's important to be in good health. You know, to be able to practice Virya Paramita, to follow this path, you need to be in good health, and your body needs to be alive. There is definitely a kind of connection, I think, between healthy body and healthy mind. I mean, it's not always like that. Sometimes we can be completely beaten up physically, but our mind can be very, very healthy. It doesn't mean healthy body, healthy mind automatically. It doesn't work like that. But I certainly think, as a support for practice, it's very important that the body is in good health, and it's sort of flowing physically as much as it can. I'm very impressed, I have to say, I have to acknowledge, after all these years, by our yogis, and we've got two very prominent yogis, hatha yogis, that is, Surita and Dharmapriya. They're very positive people. Very positive people. And I think it's got a lot to do with their yoga practice. It's got a lot to do with their general spiritual practice. But I'm sure it's got a lot to do with their yoga practice. I've got no doubt that it's a spiritual practice for them, in the context in which they practice it, which is practicing the Dharma, not just for themselves, but for the benefit of others. And it's probably might be worth, popping into the little yoga shala we've got, the yoga school at lunchtime, and getting a few tips. I'm trying to get there myself, but other things keep coming up. But I will try. I really do believe in this, even though I don't practice it. Whoops. So Virya, which is ever ready, is about becoming spiritually alive. There is the bodhicitta. You can open up to it. You can bring it alive in yourself. You can transform yourself. It's having an energy which expresses that. You can work for the good of others. So not as a set of ideas, but as a kind of energy. And we need to keep mind and body in such a condition so that we can give as full expression to that energy as possible. In the Vajrayana, in the Tantra, they ask where in ordinary experience can be found transcendental qualities and attributes. And it's very interesting. They say that the reflection, as it were, of bodhicitta in ordinary experience is in semen. In fact, one of the meanings of virya is semen. And virya can actually mean virile. I think in Marathi, we have to be careful when we give lectures on virya. I've done it myself, and people are laughing because virya means being, virile and sexy and all that sort of thing. I can see Aniruddha laughing. So you have to be a bit careful when you talk about virya in Marathi. But this is very interesting. Traditionally, semen is regarded, of course, as the seed of life. No life, no offspring without semen. And it makes me think that bodhicitta, virya, what I think we can take from this is really creativity. Someone with virya who's inspired by bodhicitta will be intensely creative, even productive and responsive to others. Very, very responsive to others and to what needs to be done. And this will pour forth as creative and productive activity. One of the things that, just reflecting on this, is Banti's creativity and productivity. We've heard a lot about Banti in recent months, not in a very good light. But sometimes in these discussions, there's no mention of the intense creativity and productivity of the man. I was just thinking back to the 1984 ordination course in Tuscany, the three-month course. He did a question and answer session on lectures on the Bodhisattva ideal, the 10 pillars of Buddhism. I think he did about 20 evenings of questions and answers, long question and answer sessions, very full and very full engagement with us. I think he was getting on for about 20 ordinations, several private ordinations an evening, and then all the public ordinations. After the ordinations, he did small intimate discussion groups with the new order members and the team members. And then, if that wasn't enough, quite almost magically and spontaneously towards the end of the course, kind of excess of creativity, if you like, he gave two papers. They weren't just talks, but fully written out papers, The Journey to Il Convento and Saint Jerome Revisited, which were really his reflections on Renaissance imagery and art. And he saw a number of people each day, and I believe he was answering letters as well. So that's the kind of energy of we're looking to liberate, and that's the sort of creativity and productivity we're looking for through our practice. So that's the virya that is ever ready. We need to stir it up, rouse it up, and keep it aroused. We need to be in a state of constant arousal. Secondly, be careful with talks on virya, don't you? Get close to the edge. Secondly, there's virya that is applied work. Virya that is applied work. So it's all very well rousing ourselves, but energy, virya, needs to be applied. Applied to actual practices, disciplines, and conduct. It needs to be applied to an actual path, to an actual system of spiritual practice and discipline. That pure capacity for virya can become dissipated, wasted, frittered away, unless there is consistent application to a course of practice. In a way, it's fairly easy to be turned on. I've sort of seen this myself. I've been in this state myself. You know, you can get turned on by a good Dharma talk or a good study group, or you can even turn people on. But in a way, that doesn't matter unless that arousal is actually applied to practice. And I think related to this is the whole notion of spiritual commitment, of commitment to a particular path of practice, not just to Buddhism in general, but to a particular tradition and a particular approach. Because there is so much available these days, so much on offer, you can dip into this and you can dip into that. You can dip out of this and you can dip out of that. And one can end up never really doing anything with any thoroughness. And you really won't get very far with that approach. As it's said, I think this is a Zen saying, but I also have heard recently it might actually come from a Hindu teacher. If you want to fill a bucket, drop the bucket right down into the well. Don't bring it up after just putting it in for a few seconds. You know, you've got to drop it right down in to fill up the bucket. And this was what was behind this need to commit oneself to a particular kind of practice. This was behind the old Mitra criteria of what was called not shopping around. People, you know, really took issue with that phrase. And some people thought, well, isn't this sort of being sectarian and cultish and so on? And perhaps the way it was applied, perhaps people didn't really understand always what was being got at. Banti introduced this himself because he believed that you really started to get serious as a spiritual practice when you committed yourself to a particular course of practice. That's when you really got serious. And Banti was very concerned. in the early days that we were serious, that we weren't playing around. I had a very interesting conversation with Naga Bodhi a few months back, and he was telling me about what it was like being around Bhante in the really early days, before even I came along in the you know, sort of early 70s. And he said, well, one of the things that Bhante did for us, he hauled us into the Dharma. He made it clear that this isn't a game, this isn't something to muck about with. You know, you can try a bit of Buddhism one day, a bit of Sufism the next day. You know, if spiritual life is a very serious business that you give yourself to very, very fully and thoroughly. And, Naga Bodhi was saying, you know, thank goodness that he did that, that he made it clear how serious it was. Now, that issue of going to other teachers and traditions, we feel is really more appropriate for, really in relation to someone who's asked for ordination. And certainly as a preceptor, personally, I would really need a lot of convincing before I ordained someone who was exploring other spiritual groups. I would really want to check out how serious they really were about ordination into the Western Buddhist Order. It's not I'm saying it's wrong to do that. It could be that I'm wrong, but I believe very passionately it's very, very important to practice a particular approach for years and years and years and years before you start experimenting with other approaches or trying out other approaches. I'd really need to be convinced about how deep somebody really was going into the Dharma if they were exploring things with other teachers. So it's not enough that there's a sort of general commitment. We need to apply ourselves for many, many years, years and years on end, to a specific course of practice. And this is a thoroughly traditional approach. This isn't, you know, some weird invention by the FWBO. This is thoroughly traditional. So there's two kinds of virya, which is applied work. There's steady engagement and enthusiastic engagement. Let's look at enthusiastic engagement first, because it's the fun one. So enthusiastic engagement is simply the joyful engagement with one's practice. Meditation, study, the tasks of daily life, helping others and so on, practicing generosity and all the rest of it, ethical conduct, working for the Dharma. One needs to work on cultivating enthusiasm for these things. If enthusiasm wanes or isn't present, you need to sit down and think, well, and remind yourself, why am I doing all this? Why do I do these things? Look for and find why you're doing it, and also find what interests you in what you're doing. You can't expect enthusiasm just to happen of itself. I think this brings up the whole issue of boredom and spiritual life. You know, it's very easy for us. It happens. People get bored with the work they do, or they get bored with the study groups. They get bored with retreats. And I think boredom is probably more of an issue than ever before in our age. We're so used to being entertained. I think when we get some perspective on our culture, we'll see it's a culture it was a culture of distraction and entertainment. And it's incredible, just the bombardment of things to just distract ourselves from our purpose. You know, with the increase in computers, internet, email, DVDs, videos, CDs, iPods, you know, all the different things that there are. I'm not saying you can't use these things skillfully, don't get me wrong. I'm not a Luddite and think that all machines should be destroyed. But you really wonder about the effect. I mean, I see sometimes on the trains, you know, like you see people, sometimes they've got their headphones on and they've got their Game Boy going. You think, my goodness, how are they going to turn out? Do they relate to the world at all? Really weird. It's not of anything really, but be with ourselves. Be with life, because then we'd end up with that terrible question, what am I actually here for? And the spiritual life will involve encountering boredom. Absolutely no question about it. When you're on retreat, especially, well, any retreat, but especially a meditation retreat, especially a solitary retreat, if it's a proper one, you know, a real solitary retreat where there's no television, no radio, no Walkman, telephone, mobile and all the rest of it. I laugh, but you know, Banti said, was horrified when somebody wrote to him and said, I had a really good solitary, I watched lots of television. Banti thought, oh my goodness, a terrible, terrible misunderstanding. But when you're on a real retreat, when you do it properly, you run out of tricks. You do, you run out of all the tricks that you have, you know, to entertain yourself, to make yourself feel all right and secure. You're brought back to yourself. And you have to find, you have to cultivate a genuine enthusiasm for what you're actually doing. A genuine enthusiasm coming from you, coming from life itself. So we need to work on looking for those things that stimulate enthusiasm in ourselves, in our practice. But there will be times when there isn't enthusiasm, so this brings up steady engagement. And of the two, steady engagement is probably the most important. Just consistent, persistent application, day in, day out, moment by moment, to the actual practices and situations in which we find ourselves, on the cushion or off it, year after year after year. We're training to be marathon runners rather than sprinters. For what we're doing on the Bodhisattva path. You know, we're running, you know, the marathon. That's what we're training for. So long-term, steady engagement. I must say, I hope I'm not embarrassing him, but I find Surita a great example of this steady application of effort. I think, you know, Surita is a very quiet person. Doesn't sort of... you know, say a lot. Well, I mean, he does actually when you get him going in a group. Eventually, he really gets going. So watch out, those of you who are in Surita's group. And he doesn't advertise himself and all the rest of it. But I've lived with him for 14 years now, known him for many, many years. And one of the things that I find so impressive and very different from me, I have to say. I tend to be a bit of I go in bursts. I'm one of those. But Surita impressed me so much with his steady, consistent application to practice. You know, regularity of practice and routine. You know, you can almost set your clock by Surita. And there's this consistent positivity that goes with it as well. Very interesting. Banti learnt from an old Brahmin in India, you know, who was a very strict Brahmin with his, you know, very regular practices. Banti said, you always knew what he was doing at any particular time of day. And his comment was, this old Brahmin, a regular life brings strength. A well-regulated life brings strength. And Banti really took that on in terms of his own practice, you know, getting into consistent daily habits. You know, you meditate at the same time, you know, you study at the same time, and so on and so forth, and you keep going, you keep doing it. If, say, with meditation, you practice for a bit and then you stop, you practice for a bit and then you stop, you won't get very far. You won't get very far at all. It's like trying to boil water by, you know, heating the water off and then turning it off before it comes to the boil. You know, all right, we're going to have a cup of tea, and then you just for some reason turn it off. Weird thing to do. So we need to persistent, consistent effort in our practice, actually applied to particular practices. So thirdly, there's the virya, which does not lose heart. I think probably everyone has experienced faint-heartedness, the feeling that they just lose heart with themselves, with the Dharma, with their practice, maybe even with other people. That feeling that, especially, that you just can't do it. You rouse your energy, you apply yourself, but it's so hard, so difficult, so painful sometimes. Even if you seem to be doing well yourself, you look around and you find others just so unresponsive. You know, you've really tried, you know, you've really kind of worked, and then others are so unresponsive. It must be very, very difficult if you're a bodhisattva. You know, you do some good and people just walk away or abuse you, or they're just not interested. I suppose if you're a true bodhisattva, you just wouldn't be bothered by all that. You know, it was obviously an issue for the early Buddhists, this faint-heartedness as well, because given how much they address the issue. And I find that encouraging. I find it encouraging that, you know, they keep addressing it, you know, because I think there's a tendency to think that we're sort of uniquely flawed in the modern age. You know, we've got sort of unique problems which the early Buddhists didn't have. Dogen goes into this, doesn't he, in one of his discourses, you know, that where he really talks about faint-heartedness. And he said, you know, people think, you know, that in the Buddha's day they were all saints, all the disciples of the Buddha. He said, not, they were, that's not the case. You know, a lot of the Buddha's disciples were really, you know, just as ignorant and stupid and so on as we are today. But they practiced, they made progress, they changed. So losing heart is universal. It happens to us all. And the quote often rolled out in the texts, you know, to inspire us is that, look, the Tathagata has taught that even worms and gnats can gain enlightenment. Even worms and gnats have the Buddha nature. Well, you know, we might debate about worms and gnats, but I take that quote in this way. Sometimes we feel like a worm. We feel like a worm. I do quite often. But that's okay. Worms can gain enlightenment. It doesn't matter if you feel like a worm or you feel like, I don't know, your favourite lowly animal. It doesn't matter. You can gain enlightenment. It doesn't actually matter, actually, how you feel about yourself. You can still gain enlightenment. You can still progress. So you don't even have to deny your lowly status if, you know, that's how you really feel you are. But that lowly status can actually change and transform. Of course, if we ever get into the thing of feeling, well, no, you know, you don't understand. I'm actually unique. I'm unique in my particular, you know, flawedness, in my particular kind of, you know, sin, you know, the problems I've had in my life and, you know, just the way I am. But of course, that is just arrogance. That's just conceit. You know, that's the conceit of feeling that you're just uniquely low, which is really as bad as feeling that you're uniquely high. So, you know, we can't get round it that way. But what to do when we're really struggling? You know, we don't feel we can do it. Well, I'm quite fond of something that the poet William Stafford said when he was asked, well, you know, what do you do if you feel you can't write poetry? And his reply was, lower your standards. And I think that's really good. I think that's a really good thing to say, you know, to get going. You know, you feel you can't get started or you can't engage. Lower your standards. Change tack. The issue, remember, is the generation of skillful states for the benefit of self and others. That's what you're trying to do. So go for a, you know, go for a lower level of skillful state. Just try and work a bit more gently, if you like. If your meditation is very hard and difficult, well, track back. You know, well, what about my ethics? Could I improve that? What about dana? What about generosity? This is, you know, often said to be the remedy for all sorts of problems and difficulties. Buddha Ghosha says that, you know, if you can't overcome ill will and hatred, give a gift to the person you dislike. Give a gift to them. Which is very interesting because, you know, dana is so easy. Giving is so easy. You know, all you have to do is, well, just put your hand in your pocket and give the money. You know, or pick the flowers and give the bunch of flowers. It's very, very easy to do it. And, you know, we're not going to talk about Dana Paramita today, but I think that Dana is an incredibly underestimated practice within among us. a practice, you know, whereby one can actually make progress and generate skillful states. You know, we like the idea of working on the mind, but you know, we don't realise that the effect of generosity, what that can do in shifting, you know, rather blocked states, as it were. So we can also, I think, when we lose heart, is just notice what has actually changed. Take stock. Sometimes we're looking for something very big. We think that change is going to be sort of cataclysmic. You know, we read the accounts of the great teachers, and, you know, what we notice is the cataclysmic insight or the cataclysmic meditation experience. We overlook the fact, you know, there's 20 years of daily practice of just getting off it, of just getting on with it, of digging at the coal face, as it were. And change is often very, very subtle. I remember I had a phone conversation some years ago with Banti. I was staying over in the house when it was what was known as the order office, and Banti phoned up to get one of the people working there, but I was manning the phone, and we had a little chat, and he said, well, how are you getting on? And I said, well, you know, Banti, spiritual progress seems so slow. I mean, it seems to be really nothing happening, you know, or if it is, it's sort of infinitesimal. And Subhuti had just left Padmaloka, and when he lived here, and I was really feeling that. I think we were all feeling that. And Bandi said, well, you know, I really miss Subhuti, you know, because Subhuti was in retreat in Spain. He said, well, I miss him. And he said, yes, I know how it feels. And I said, yeah, it's really, you know, spiritual progress, Banti. I just don't really think, you know, there's much happening. And he just started to say, it's measurable, measurable, measurable. He just kept saying this word, measurable. There's, you know, it's just saying, look, there is progress, measurable progress. He just kept saying it. I was insisting there wasn't much, and he kept saying, no, it's measurable, measurable. So I found that very interesting, and very encouraging, of course, you know, to look differently at oneself. Of course, this is where spiritual friends are very helpful to us. We, you know, they can often see us much more clearly than we can see ourselves, and they can say, "Well, no, you are. You're doing well. You're doing well." If you are making effort, spiritual effort, if you're making the effort to generate skillful states in meditation, outside of meditation, something is happening. Change is going on. And nothing is wasted. No spiritual effort is wasted. So if you've been incredibly generous to somebody and they've just walked away from you or abused you, your spiritual effort is not wasted. Regardless of what they've done or what they do, you are contributing. You've made a contribution to the general good in the world. And that affects you, and that affects the world. And this is, of course, what punya is all about. Something is happening. So don't lose heart. So fourthly, the virya which does not turn back. In the White Lotus Sutra, which I hope you've all studied during the course of your Mitra study course, you'll recall that 5,000 people walked out when the Buddha announced that he was about to give a new teaching, a teaching surpassing all earlier teachings. Of course, when we read this, we all identify with the people who stayed to listen to the Buddha. We all identify with the Buddha, of course. Silly people. But the fact is, we can often be the people who walk out or who feel like walking out, because committing ourselves to the spiritual path, to the Bodhisattva path, involves stepping into the unknown. Commitment, by definition, if you are going to commit yourself, means that you step into the unknown. If you knew everything that was going to happen, there would be no need for commitment. Commitment implies stepping into something unknown. Ordination into the Western Buddhist order is definitely a step into the unknown. We make a lot of this in particular at the private ordination. We really bring that out. You go off on your own to your private preceptor, And you don't know what you're going into. You're stepping into the tiger's cave. Tracks lead up to the tiger's cave. No tracks come out. So participating in a sangha is participating in the unknown. Inevitably, when we take up the Dharma, we have all sorts of expectations about how things will be. I will do this, I will be like that. We have a sort of sense of a straight white path. Like I said, you know, I thought after I was ordained, in 2 years' time the bodhicitta will arise, you know, and I had this idea, you know, somewhere, you know, not a clear thing, but I'd just be sort of sailing along the bodhicitta, you know, kind of invincible, and you know, it would all be so straightforward. The reality is very different. As Bhante says, the way is a hacked path, roughly made through densest jungle. We find ourselves confronted with things that are unexpected. Obstacles, challenges, teachings, truths, possibilities, people that need to be engaged with. We even find ourselves actually thinking, I've certainly thought this, I never asked for this. I never asked for this. This isn't the order I joined. Well, of course I didn't ask for it. And of course it's not the order I joined. How could it be in such a changing world? And, you know, we invite transformation. In meditation sometimes, we're confronted with unpalatable truths about ourselves, about our lives, or in communication, or in friendship. And the desire comes up to turn back, to turn back. Something may arise, something will arise that you just don't expect. And again, the desire will arise to just turn back. It's very interesting thinking back to what it was like being around Bhante in the early days. When he was around, there was this almost constant challenge to us all. I mean, that's one of the things I think he did for us, was this almost constant, regular challenge. You know, you'd go on a seminar, or you'd go to see him, or you'd go to a talk, and there were these new directions that were opened up. You know, you'd go on a seminar and he'd really emphasise the importance of work and responsibility, you know, and really working for the Dharma. You know, or he'd really emphasise, you know, the need for more study or something like that. Or he'd suddenly say, right, we're going to have a 3-month ordination course every year. It completely freaked the chairman out at the time when he did that. No, you can't do this, Bhante. What about our centres? What about our businesses? No, we're doing this. You know, this, and, you know, the feeling is, you know, this is a bit much. Sometimes he said to people, do nothing, which is not what they've expected. I was talking to a Dharmacharini who's really into doing, and Bhante said, do nothing, do nothing. Very, very difficult for her. So the virya that does not turn back means that one doesn't abandon one's original intention just because the going has become more difficult than one had expected. One doesn't abandon one's original intention just because the going has become more difficult than one had expected. Gampopa speaks of this in terms of not turning back in the face of being mocked, criticised, or scorned by others. It seems to be understood from looking at the literature to do with the Mahayana that if you follow the Bodhisattva path, if you attempt to do some good, you're very likely going to open yourself to criticism from other people. But you don't turn back when that happens. You don't turn back at the prospect of that happening. You know, I know sometimes people, I see this in myself, I won't do something because I'm worried about what people will think of me. I'm worried about what people will think of me. Well, if I don't do that thing, that means I'm turning back from the skillful because I'm more concerned about what people will think of me. So this, of course, brings out the heroic warrior aspect of following the Bodhisattva path. One of the great inspirations for me in this is Dr. Ambedkar and his followers. You know, when Dr. Ambedkar decided to convert to Buddhism the Indian government said, well, okay, if you become Buddhists, you will not be able to have the reservations for the scheduled caste, the so-called untouchable people. So more or less bribing, trying to bribe that community into staying within the Hindu fold. And Dr. Ambedkar and his followers would not have it. As Dr. Ambedkar said, you know, we've started this movement to develop our minds, not for material gain. And I met people who told me that after the conversion, these people were quite old when I met them, they were boycotted. After they became Buddhist, they weren't the shopkeepers in their village. There's only a couple of shops, wouldn't sell them food, wouldn't sell them the basics. And I said, but well, how did you feel about that? I said, well, it didn't matter, because actually we felt so free in becoming Buddhist, in leaving Hinduism, in leaving the caste system. You know, we were prepared to put up with that. I think that's tremendous. I think that it really is the virya that does not turn back, and indeed the virya that doesn't lose heart as well. Fifthly, there's the virya that is never satisfied. The Bodhisattva's virya is never satisfied. He never comes to an end in his Bodhicharya. There are always more samadhis to explore. There are always more beings to liberate. There's always more to perfect. If it's true for the Bodhisattva, it must be true for us. So often we put up with, we tolerate a rather mediocre state of consciousness. We'd actually tolerate low-level negativity. Bhante said he thought that that's what he'd observed, that that's what a lot of people do. They kind of just tolerate low-level negative states. A bit like putting up with bad weather. You know, the English are very good at this, putting up with bad weather. So, you know, in the same way we can put up with being in low-level negative states. We just get used to it and sort of satisfied with it. But we need to see that we could do so much more. We could be so much more. We could do so much more. There needs to be this constant questioning. How can I take things further? Not in an anxious, fretting sort of way. That's anxiety. It's not like that. It's, yes, you're contented. You're at ease with yourself, but you're not satisfied. You have a clear sense of the need to deepen your practice and extend your friendliness and make your friendliness more effective. The Bodhisattva is contented but not satisfied. He's at ease with himself, but he's keenly aware that there is more to do and there is more to be done to benefit others. Of course, we don't just need to apply this individually. We need to think of this collectively. We're not just soloists here. We're a spiritual community. So as a collective, we need to ask ourselves, how can we do more to benefit the world? The commentators on this speak of this state of the virya that is never satisfied, as Gampopa speaks of it, as someone who doesn't have a high opinion of himself, which is very interesting. So it's actually a state of humility. Genuine humility, not that kind of false, horrible humility, which is another version of pride. But humility in the sense of, you know that there is more to learn, there's more to change, there's more to do. And I think that this virya that's never satisfied becomes in the end the Bodhisattva's lila, his lalata, his play, his sport, his game. The work of liberating beings, of practicing the Dharma, is the Bodhisattva's play, his sport. It's natural, it's free-flowing, it's the expression of his energy. He's not thinking about an end point. There's no end point. In the Mahayana, they talk not so much about the nirvana without remainder that you find in the Pali text, you find in early Buddhism. In the Mahayana, they talk about the nirvana that is non-abiding. The nirvana that abides neither in samsara or nirvana. That's the Bodhisattva's nirvana. It's non-abiding. He abides nowhere, if you like. So He has ego-less energy. Ego-less energy. Just free-flowing. This seems very far away, and of course it is very far away, but it's important, I think, to be aware of that ideal. Sometimes I notice in myself, and I notice in others, kind of making heavy weather of spiritual life, which means it can just be incredibly ego-based. I think this is one of the things that can afflict us. You know, we can put a lot of effort in to our practice, to our work for the Dharma and so on. But it can get tied up with status and all that sort of thing. We need to realise that what we're looking for is something very, very free, you know, very, very fresh. Keep in mind that play. We need to refresh our enthusiasm and our inspiration. And I think as well, another aspect of this is keeping a sense of humour, in the sense of keeping a sense of proportion and perspective on ourselves. We need to be able to laugh at ourselves, laugh at taking ourselves so seriously. Good humour is, I think, a very good healthy sign. Being able to, yes, to laugh at ourselves. So already this is rather a long talk, and you've probably needed quite a bit of virya and patience, probably, to stay with it. But just a few more things to say. I've used the word energy a lot. I think because I actually like the word energy. And energy is just so important for spiritual life. If our energy is blocked, if it's weak, if it's dissipated, if it's turgid, it's, you know, spiritual progress for self and other is just going to be very, very difficult. In tantric tradition, the spiritual life is frequently seen in terms of energy, in terms of the liberation of energy. Indeed, life is seen as the play of a kind of wisdom energy. And Bhante himself has said, in the context of using the language of conditioned co-production, insubstantiality, shunyata, he said, what's really going on, that kind of insight, it's more as if, it's not seeing everything broken up into bits, but more that you see that life, that beings are a flow of energy, that people are flows of energy. It's all energy. You know, and he speaks of the Bodhisattva as really being a transpersonal stream of spiritual energy. So in participating in our order, in our spiritual community, we're trying to open up to that transpersonal stream of spiritual energy. We're trying to see everything in terms of energy rather than in terms of these fixed, separated blocks. You know, when you read in the Avatamsaka Sutra the descriptions, the vivid descriptions of how the Bodhisattva sees the world, it's so dynamic, so alive, such incredible energy, all these intersecting beams of light and so on. Many years ago, Bhante was obviously looking at things in terms of energy, probably very popular in the early days of the movement. And he came up with what he called the tantric version of the five precepts. It's a very interesting set, and they fit well into a discussion of a Bodhisattva's energy, and they anticipate the next talk, which is going to be on Sila Paramita, the perfection of ethics. So I'm just going to end by reading you, without any comment, the tantric version of the five precepts. So I'll read these and then we'll sit in silence for a little while. The tantric version of the five precepts. 1. Do not obstruct the energy of any other person. 2. Do not drain the energy of others. Give freely of your own energy. 3. Do not misuse energy. 4. Use for any given purpose the energy appropriate to that purpose, not one which is inappropriate. 5. Do not allow energy to become turbid. Keep it clear and bright.